Welcome to the Man Fulfilled podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Bell. When I turned 40 years old, I made the decision to make the best of life, and I dedicated myself to the pursuit of health, self-improvement, and healing. My mission for this show is to share what I have learned and researched so that men everywhere can find purpose, health, success, and fulfillment. Hello, hello, friends. It is me, your host, Matthew Bell. And today I have an amazing guest for us today. He's a close friend, mentor, and someone I consider both a brother and a peer. His name is Jeff Heilman. He has been a top 1% sales executive in the tech industry for nearly 30 years. In his career, he has worked with Oracle, Cisco, Intel, IBM, and several successful startups. He's been a part of six exits with over $1.3 billion in transaction value. He has seen it all. He has seen ups and downs, peaks and valleys throughout his career, and is someone who is an absolute perfect fit for the Man Fulfilled community. He has a lot to offer and is someone who I have gained tremendous insight from over the years. He has a podcast of his own called The Jeff Heilman Project, which I want to call out before we get started. You can find his show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and I highly recommend subscribing to it. I know this is a show that is going to inspire you, motivate you, and encourage you. So without further ado, here is my deep and wide-ranging conversation with the one and only Jeff Heilman. All right, well, here I am. I'm with Jeff Heilman, a very dear friend, someone who I respect in business, someone who I respect as a mentor, big brother figure, friend. We met, 7 years ago now at this point, and have stayed close throughout that. And I think we have some really interesting stories. We've done some business together. But Jeff, I just want to take a minute and welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Matt. Super excited to be here and be doing this with you after years of working all around it, and we finally getting it done.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give my 30-second intro on who you are, and then I want you to fill in all the gaps and just tell the audience who is Jeff Heilman, why you have something of value to share. And I really do. I call you whenever I need a pick me up. I call you when I have questions or need advice, and you've been super helpful in recommending good books, ways of doing life, mindfulness tactics, organizational tactics and skills and things of that nature. So Jeff Heilman has what now a 25, 30 year career in the tech industry, in mostly on the sales side. And you've sold close to $300 million worth of technical solutions or something of that nature. You've been quoted in Elon Musk's book. And you have met the who's who of Silicon Valley tech founders and entrepreneurs, played golf with some of them at Pebble Beach, and help the audience fill in those blanks. Give me the Jeff Heilman introduction.
Well, good morning, Matt. Thanks. I would say that I am a person who is in the right place at the right time for a long time. And from that was able to establish more emotional control over time than I had when I was a kid, because I watched it happen from the people around me. And because of that, I've been able to take advantage of some opportunities and build some companies and do some things in technology, which really give a force multiplier of wealth and recognition far beyond what most people deserve. Simply because of the timing. It's like the railroads in the 1820s and 30s were hot. So if you're in the railroad, you're going to make 5 times more or 10 times more than people that are working, fixing wagon wheels. And so same thing with the jet airline business in the 1960s, and the same thing with technology in the 90s and 2000s and 2010s. So, certainly hardworking, certainly ambitious, but not particularly amazing in and of myself, different from anybody else, just, working hard and being in the business for a long time.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I think you're being modest, and humble, which is great, but I think, I think you have some interesting stories and a lot to share. So one of the things, you know, you've told me over the years, you've met a lot of really exciting, interesting people, and you carry these tidbits with you, and various stories and encounters have helped to shape how you think and helped to contribute to your path to success and the journey you've been on. You have a couple that come to mind. And, you know, the part of the podcast that, you know, the goal here is to inspire men to unlock the capacity to live a fulfilled life. And that goes for health, wellness, business, relationships, et cetera. And I think, you know, if every man were to ask themselves honestly, there's always that pursuit of wanting more in life and wanting to go after things, even if they get stuck in a rut, right? So one time, and you're going to have to fill in the blanks on this story for me, but one time you played golf at Pebble Beach with the founder of Kayak.com, if I'm remembering correctly.
He wasn't a founder. He was a VC who funded.
VC. Okay. So
no, right. You're right. He did. He had sold this guy by the name of David Fialco, and he had built a big travel business, several $100 million travel business with his best friend. And I think actually he is a VC. He is a Sundance Film Festival movie maker now. And has a big VC firm in Boston, one of the biggest ones, Catalyst. But I was paired with him. He had a fourth that dropped out. I was at Pebble Beach that night and I was a single, and my wife sent me there to get away and rest, kind of like what she's doing this weekend. And, there's, you know, we jest about it, but no, she's not mad. I'm just resting. And I was at Pebble Beach and I was the fourth, and I played golf with this gentleman. And I believe he was either a founding member or the chief counsel for, or the seed round of funding for, or the founder of Kayak in some capacity. So I think Kayak was bigger than just one guy as a founding team. But yeah, he was at the very beginning of that and did really well there. And then that was like just the beginning of a series of hundreds of successful builds after that. And that was... It's one of those things, right? Being around the right people at the right time, staying at the fancy places and spending, you know, sometimes money that makes you uncomfortable will put you in circles of people that, you know, they don't hang out at the places where, you know, people making $100,000, $200,000 tend to hang out.
Yeah. And that's awesome. But there's a part of the story, I think that I've grabbed hold of, over the years that I don't think you touched on, which is he gave you a piece of advice. What was that piece of advice? I think you had the guts to just pull him aside and ask him, you know, what's your key to success or something of that nature? And I think he said something to the effect of just say yes, or just say yes to everything. Was this the right story?
It was more about the fact. So I'm, you know, let's just say there's a pretty significant gap in our quality of life and net worth between these two guys. So I'm gonna play golf, and I'm gonna focus on playing golf and hit some great shots and keep up with everybody. But if I can, this guy's hugely successful. I'm gonna ask him some questions, right? And he told me he rode his bike 53. We teed off at like 11 in the morning. He had ridden his bike 53 miles that morning already, like out and back and out on 17-mile drive already that morning from Pebble. A really ambitious guy, hardworking guy, incredible shape. He was like 10 years older than me and just super, super good shape. So I'm going to ask him, like, what don't people ask you? What do you wish they asked you and they don't ask you? And he says, well, he said they always ask about the wins. You know, he had umpteen million shares of Airbnb and umpteen million shares of Snapchat and founder of Kayak. And he'd done another 100 exits, all of which were hundreds of millions and billions of dollars a piece. And I'm sure his net worth is in the billions at this point. And he said they always ask about the success, but they never ask about the failures. And I said, well, let me be the one to ask about the failures, right? Tell me about them. Like, what? And what can we learn from that process? And he says, well, he said, you know, we've had 100 exits or whatever it is. He said, but I've also written, he said, 1,100 checks on the front for like a million or 10 million or more. 1,100 checks on the front that effectively bounced out of the ecosystem of technology, because there is no business named or unnamed, that is in existence today in exchange for those 1,100 investments.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm griping because I went broke three times and I'm building it back a fourth time. And it's like, I haven't even gotten started in the real failures yet that would propel somebody into that billionaire status. And it really brings us to the crux of the story, which is that the bigger you are, the more failures you have overcome. It's an equation. Mm. It's not something that can be, you know, skated or gotten around, or you can ignore it, but it's coming for you. If you're going to be big in any business, in a marriage, in kids, in society, as a statesman, as an influencer on social media, as a YouTuber, you're going to deal with three or four times more failures on the beginning than you might even think is even possible. But in the process of doing that, success comes from momentum. And momentum comes from making the right decisions over and over and over and over and over and over, with nothing stopping you, nothing slowing you down, nothing breaking that stride. That's how you run that 4-minute mile, is thousands of steps that are all exactly right, the most possible efficiency built into what you're doing. And in order to get that level of efficiency, you got to figure out all the other things that are getting in the way of that efficiency and get rid of them, which is why failure is the critical component for success. And the appetite for failure and the willingness to push through after you've come to a complete halt is the single highest determining factor for success, in my opinion.
Wow, there's a lot there. And you're touching on a topic that is something very special, at least in terms of how I want to focus on this show. As I've shared, and my audience knows, I started this podcast after a personal failure. I went through a divorce. I felt like I was at the bottom, and I wanted to be an inspiration and help other men know that there is life after failure. There is life. There's a better life. There's an opportunity. There is, you know, your best open doors are ahead of you. And, you know, many successful business people and entrepreneurs fail. You know, Steve Jobs failed. Elon Musk has failed. Everyone has failed along the way. Building resilience in business, life, relationships is critical to continuing to move forward. So tell me specifically from your perspective, and I know you have a lot of good kind of frameworks and things that you focus on in your day-to-day operations, but how do you personally cultivate resilience in the face of challenges or failure? Like, a lot of people can just be slammed to the bottom. How do you personally pick yourself up off of a failure? Say you went broke, say you went bankrupt, or you lost it all. I know you've had a businesses boom and you've been part of very successful exits. I know you've had, you know, businesses that have lost it all and you've lost your equity in certain deals. How do you do it? How do you pick yourself up by the bootstraps and keep moving on even when you feel like so down? And I know logically my mind says, you know, you have to keep going, but there's a lot involved. There's emotion, there's fear, there's, you know, there's shame, there's all these things that come up as you go through failure. What is your personal kind of formula to pick yourself up after a failure?
Well, that's such a good question, and I can say that the answer is, it's different every time and it's the same every time, right? If it's a relationship with somebody that I really, you know, I lost a friendship with a dear fellow entrepreneur, and we'd done business together and worked together for a long time. And eventually this person just stopped calling me back. We had a coffee meeting about 3 or 4 years ago, and I thought it went really well, and he was doing well and I was doing well. And then it just ended. Right. And it didn't end right away. It ended with me texting, "Hey, how's it going? Hey, are you okay? I haven't heard from you in a while," you know, that kind of thing. And we're talking about, you know, 15 plus year relationship with this person. And then it just ended slowly, painfully. I came to the realization that I had done something wrong, and I tried triangulating it and figuring out what it was. And it was not anything that seemed like worthy of ending a relationship over. But if people are looking to end a relationship, they'll latch on to any offense they can find, as I'm sure you've seen.
Sure. In your own, yeah.
Own relationship.
Been there, friend.
And and this just kind of ended, and it was painful because we were very close. And so I think, I wish I could tell you that, oh, well, you do this and then you do this and then you do this, and this is my process for how to get over it. But it seems like it's more of a subconscious gift that we have in our nervous systems that just, there's something like your liver. I don't get up and say, hey, I'll be doing just fine as soon as I can get my liver started this morning, right? It operates automatically. And so that healing serum in relationships operates automatically for us at a subconscious level. And eventually just, you know, the wham emotional wave that's going through your body and nervous system when you find out that this failure has occurred, whether it's relationship or finances, that wave, just like if you're yelling at someone across the room, right, they can hear you at a loud concert. But if you yell across somebody, if you yell at somebody across town, they can't hear you, right? It dissipates. The wave of emotion dissipates throughout time and space naturally. And once that dissipates, unless we have it hooked into our nervous system and we keep repeating the failure, oh, she left me, oh, she left me, oh no, I'm never gonna find it. And then we're sitting there going, it's like a repeater. Like if you have an internet repeater in your house to make the Wi-Fi a little bit better, right? So I would say the process or the thing is just kill the repeater, right? Because yeah. we make that wave signal go longer than it needs to go versus just
that's good.
Pedaling and saying it's going to dissipate because the air only carries our voice so far. The water only carries the tsunami so far, and eventually everything settles. And then recognizing once you've been through that, you know, a dozen times or 100 times, you start to say, okay, I'm going to give myself a day or a month to sit here and have my pity party and feel bad. And then, you know, the kids still need to eat.
Yeah.
The mortgage still needs to get paid and the car still needs gas in it and it to get going. And then your focus shifts and you're like, okay, I can deal with the emotion of having lost this friendship because it's not the only friend I have. And you can play the sour grapes and all that stuff in your head, but eventually it just, okay, this person does not want to have a relationship anymore and we need to move forward. And then you go fill your life with other people or with other job opportunities or other income streams.
Yeah, that's good. You know, you mentioned something that reminded me of another story you told. And Jeff, I remember all your stories. And me and Stan, and just, you know, Jeff's been a mentor to me. He's been a mentor to my brother. He's been a mentor to other business people in my life. Came down to Austin. We did a whole like fun brainstorming whiteboard session about some business opportunities. Just truly inspiring. You know, I would call it, we got white hot in terms of Jeff Heilman language. But you mentioned once that, and I'm going to butcher maybe setting up the stage for this. I hope you remember the story correctly, but you were having a conversation at work, either with an employer or a boss or a coworker, and the topic of pressure came up. And you responded with, I think your version of pressure and mine are very different. You have to tell the story because it's a wow. It's like what you just said is in terms of overcoming failure and getting back on the track. I think
I haven't thought about that in a while. That's really funny.
Yeah, that story stuck with me. I was like, you know what? Because at the end of the day, you go through divorce, your ex-wife takes all your assets or whatever the case may be. You have a daughter, you've got child support to pay. You can't sit in that pity party forever, and pressure is different for everyone. And I would love for you to bring that story to the surface and tell the whole thing, because it gave me perspective in that moment that I needed.
Okay, I'll tell you the story. I can't believe you remember that. That's funny. It's been years since that happened. That was in, I want to say 2015. So it was like 8 years ago. So here's the thing. I tend to run hot, and in the beginning, so you know, I did not learn emotional control as a child. And you can blame that, or you can imagine what the reasons would be. But, you know, it's somewhat traumatic, somewhat, you know, just parental influence and a lot of change and divorce of my parents and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I'm responsible for everything that happens to me, through me, around me, because of me. My oscillation in my own mind is my responsibility 100%. Somebody cuts me off on the freeway, I was probably following too close. Like, all you can look at that and say, look, we control the universes that we operate in, mentally, physically, spiritually, and eventually manifest it into reality. And so I've lost a lot of jobs because of that, because I was not as emotionally controlled and calm and stable. But at the same time, all of the heat that I bring, that brings the dollars in the form of sales, also is a function of emotion. So it is, you know, if you take gasoline and you dump a 5-gallon bucket of gasoline out in a field and light it on fire, you know, you're going to get arrested. But if you take that same 5 gallons of gas and you put it into a highly efficient car, it can move that 3,000-pound vehicle with 50 gallons, you know, across, probably almost across the country.
It's a good analogy. Very,
you know, if it's focused. Okay. So I lose this job. I was at IBM and I lost this job, and I'm interviewing. It might have been even longer than that, maybe 2012. So it might have been 10 years ago. So I had a friend of mine. We were not close friends, but he had been promoted to a manager job at a company that we had both worked for. I was there. He was there. I left. He stayed. He gets promoted. I'm interviewing for an opportunity to come back. And he says to me, he goes, well, how are you? There's a lot of pressure on these commit calls. How are you going to handle pressure when I'm, you know, riding your behind to try to talk about what our weekly commit call, our weekly commit number is going to be? And I just said to him, I said, well, with all due respect, I think your definition of pressure and my definition of pressure might be a little different. And so, can you maybe tell me a little bit about what you think pressure sounds like? And he said, well, we do commit calls at the last month of the quarter 3 times a week, and you've got to give updates on what you're doing on deals on Monday, on Wednesday, and on Friday in front of a large group of people, and it's not always a comfortable conversation. And I said, okay, well, that's very good. I appreciate you letting me know that. And would you mind if I gave you an example of what pressure looks like from my point of view? And he says, yeah, whatever, go ahead. I said, well, let me take you back to April of 2002 when I had a paper route to make up the additional $800 that my $1,800 job at the credit card collections at Citibank didn't cover for the rent in our apartment that had bars on the windows in North County, Escondido, part of San Diego. I had a wife that was staying home and 3 children, actually 2 children at the time, and Tuesday, I crashed my car in a field because I fell asleep at the wheel from working 100-hour weeks, got the car totaled, which was the bad news. The good news was the insurance company gave me enough to put a down payment on Wednesday on another vehicle. So I went and bought a new vehicle on Wednesday or Thursday, and then on Friday, lost the job that I was using to qualify for that vehicle at the credit card collection agency, which then put me into a receivership situation for the vehicle, which I voluntarily repossessed on Monday. So I lost the car and 2 jobs and my health insurance and my bank account because the check that came from the dealership to me bounced, which forced me to bounce the rent check that I had written against the money from the returned deposit on the car. And then on Tuesday, after no insurance, no money, no bank account, no car, and no job, found out my wife was expecting our 3rd child. Me, that is pressure. With all due respect. And he was just, you know, built like the old pinball machines, right? Had no concept of that, right? And part of the reason why I've experienced as much pressure as I have is because of the emotional lack of control, right? Those two are reciprocal. They go together. If you don't have any, if your emotional control is zero, you're going to deal with a lot of pressure because everything is pressure at that point.
Yeah.
You tend to attract more of the nonsense that goes with that. But that's why I've found that what's the opposite of not having a lot of emotional pressure, or not having a lot of emotional pressure because you don't have a lot of control. The opposite of that is mental toughness. It's the opposite. Mental toughness is the ability to control your emotions. And so as I've gone through the failures, I've learned, oh, this thing keeps happening. People keep ghosting me. I keep losing jobs. And the, this rocket ship level of force that gets companies off the ground requires emotion, but it's got to be in a nozzle to where it's pointed in the same direction and everybody comes along line on that. And you build startup companies and businesses that have that focus, just absolute unbelievable white hot intensity that, I mean, there's a reason why when you're watching a space shuttle launch live, you got to be 3 miles, 4 miles away from it, because it's so much force that it just obliterates everything within a square radius, a radius of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards, because that's how much force it takes to get that thing into space. Well, a lot of people aren't used to dealing with that level of emotion. And as a result, they get offended. Mm-hmm. People that can handle it. And that's why I was, you know, this particular person was one of the guys that helped me really harness that emotion and put it into a nozzle, which is why it hurt so bad when I lost that relationship. But when you actually see what the human being is capable of, when you actually can taste what it's like to go from $0 to $1 million in income in a year after living in an apartment with bars on the windows and getting your high school diploma in the mail after they accept your payment for the fines for your overdue library books, that's an unbelievable amount of change and transition to occur in somebody's life in a very short period of time. So the failure is part of learning the emotional control. And the emotional control is part of avoiding mistakes. And avoiding mistakes is part of what builds momentum. And momentum is what builds a fortune.
Yeah. Well, that's real good. So I think what you're talking about, you know, really is emotional intelligence. It could be described that way. Control and emotional intelligence are very, very similar. You know, I've always said I would prefer EQ over IQ. And I've really invested in myself over the last 10 years to really hone in on my emotional intelligence so that I can be good with people, so that I can know how to navigate.
To your credit, you are exceptional from an exterior perspective. I don't know what's necessarily going on the inside for you. I think you're very controlled, and your delivery, like, I've never seen you lose it. I'm sure you have.
I really appreciate that. I've definitely lost it in my younger years, but I've focused. I bought a book on emotional intelligence. I forgot the name of the book. It's something by the Harvard Review. And I really focused on it. It's a great book. I'll put it in the.
It's branded with blue with white letters on the front.
Yes. Really great book. I saw it in the airport and I was like, you know what? I'm going to read this on the plane. This looks great. That was about maybe 8, 10 years ago. So I've been really focused on it because I believe if, you know, EQ, emotional intelligence, gives you the ability to navigate complex human situations. And the key to success in business is people, right? We do business with other people.
That's right.
If you're not good with people, you're going to turn people away. You're going to have problems in your relationships. But if you can focus on emotional intelligence, it's almost like 100x more valuable than just pure IQ, who's someone who's maybe not good with people. Right. So let me ask you, sounds like you've kind of been on a path, right? In terms of your own growth. Is there anything intentional that you've been doing to invest in, as you put it, emotional control or emotional intelligence? Was it a book, or was it a practice or a framework that you've employed? Or was it really, like you said, learning from failure and then having revelation after the failure of how you need to tweak your life or things like that? Because I think this is a valuable, if I were to say, what, Matt Bell, what's your biggest piece of advice for success? It's emotional intelligence, being in control of your emotions in a way that you are a commander of your mind and your heart, so that you can guide a situation as opposed to be reactive to a situation. So I'm curious to know what you've done proactively.
So it's tough to do something the right way or the most effective way over and over and over and over. Unless you really believe that that's the crux of the thing. So I'm going to take you through a process, my process, but I'm going to condense 10 years into, you know, 5 minutes, right? The first thing you got to do is you got to fail. And then you got to say, this isn't getting me what I want. Then you got to question why the failure is happening. Then you're going to come up with the same answer that everybody else comes up with, which is it's emotional intelligence, right? I wasn't able to persist long enough, which means I got tired, which means I started making bad decisions, which were emotionally charged because I didn't have control of my faculty. And then you're like, and then it goes back to the next failure. And then I failed because I said the wrong thing at the wrong time because I was tired, right? And then the guy got offended and he left me and my business failed, right, as a result. Yeah. And then I did another one and the gal left me. Why? Because I said the wrong thing. Why? Because I was tired. And it's like, oh, once I see that every single time it comes back to the crux of a failure is a decision that was made under a position of emotional compromise.
Say that again.
The crux of a failure comes at the moment that we make a decision under a situation of a emotional compromise that effectively we don't get away with, right?
Wow. That's so good.
You can race out of that green light on a left-hand turn on a large, busy throughway. You can race off that green light and make a green turn sometimes, but you can't do it all the time and get away with it because somebody is going to run that red light. We just know that somebody is going to run the red light. And so emotional intelligence is that deep breath, not when you're on your phone looking to reorient. I'm saying you're off your phone, you're at the green light, you're going to turn left, and you still take a deep breath and you accommodate for that guy or gal that's going to run that red light one time out of 5,000. Because you know, if you don't, that one time out of 5,000, they're going to kill you.
Mm.
Okay? That is emotional intelligence played out in the area of successfully navigating a left-hand turn on a green light. Okay?
Yeah.
And so if you look at in business, why do we fail in business? Because we make, you know, left turn, right turn, left turn, right turn, left turn, right turn. And that one time when we're emotionally compromised and we don't take a deep breath and give the other guy who's probably running the red light that extra second or two, let the guys in the back honk. You're not on your phone. You're saving a life, right? That caution, once you've failed enough times that you realize that caution pause, we're not talking about Power of Habit and Charles Duhigg, where you're hesitating at the line of scrimmage on the snap count. We're talking about where you have a decision to make. It's a big one. It's not one of 80 plays in an NFL game. It's like one of three or four strategy moves in your business that's either going to multiply your assets or send you to bankruptcy court asking for forgiveness. Those decisions require that we, and there's lots of those decisions in business. Once you've failed enough times, once you've had enough relationships to where you can thin slice, right decision, 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 right, all of a sudden, right decision, right decision, right decision, right decision, right decision, with no disruption from errors, that's when you get momentum and the success just takes you from 50 grand a year to $1 million. And the emotional turning through of like, okay, I've got a dashboard in my nervous system now that says you're compromised. My wife and I have triggers back and forth to where we each get a challenge flag that we get to throw at the other one. We get to throw a challenge flag and say, you are out of control. This is not where we need to operate. And I can't always see it and she can't always see it internally, but we can always see it in the other person. And now we just call each other on that instantly. And what it does is it allows us to recalibrate and go, okay, I can't see this from the outside. I'm acting emotionally compromised. I'm going to make bad decisions to say stuff I don't mean and all that, right? If you're going to be successful, that has to be kept to an absolute, absolute minimum. And then the real pressure of success and growth comes. So it's almost like, thank you, God, that you allowed me to fail when the stakes were low. Because now that I know how to win when the stakes are low, I can handle more and more and more and more pressure as it scales, because I know that the crux of it is don't make effed up decisions in real time with huge stakes at play. If you don't Yep. do that, the natural propensity of growth is that the business is going to grow. Salespeople are going to close business for your teams. Engineers are going to come up with new stuff you can sell. Finance is going to want to give you more capital in order to grow your base. And marketing is going to build a brand that repeats and asks for you to do more in the marketplace over time. It is complicated, but it's not impossible to figure that out.
That's good. And I think, you know, there's kind of a macro and micro event cadence to emotional decision making. So micro events happen daily. You get, you know, your wife says something and you respond without, you know, you respond in an emotional way. You know, you take the garbage out. I was like, I'll do it in 1 minute. She's like, well, I always ask you, well, I'm doing something, you know, like it's, you could pause there and you can say yes, or, you know, you do make the right decision in that moment, or it's a macro event. Yeah. Client, your biggest money client sends you a dissatisfied email and they're not ready to leave or they're not ready to terminate, but it triggers you and you don't respond with the right level of pause and patience, then it could lead to, you know, loss of that client or that revenue. So super, super interesting stuff. I think, you know, we're honing in on something that I have a high value towards, which is emotional intelligence. And we've talked a lot about failure. I want to shift gears a minute here as we kind of take us into the second stretch or the final stretch of the show. You know, you're someone who's, you're vocal, you've shared your failures and ups and downs on the show. You're also a super successful salesperson and sales leader, sales executive, where companies pay you tens of thousands of dollars to train on a consulting basis. You've sold upwards of $250 million worth of tech solutions in the tech industry. That's a winning track record. So the net track record is highly successful and winning. And you have a lot of advice that you've given me, at least over the years, around, you know, developing a winning mindset and things that help you think like a winner, get white hot, focus in. And, you know, what are some of the habits that you have or frameworks, mental frameworks, you know, the things that you do to keep yourself sharp and focused? Forget about, we've talked about failure. Forget about all that stuff for a second. How do you focus on winning? You know, what is your framework? What's Jeff Heilman's formula or three-step process to maintaining a winning mindset, whatever it may be? I'd love to hear it.
Well, you can look at that from a bunch of different ways. And first of all, thank you for the question. I mean, you and I, as far as I am concerned, you and I are peers. You've had years where you made more money than me. I've learned way more from you about social media and digital and the importance of bringing brands together. So, you know, I appreciate the posture that you're using on this call, but in my opinion, it's not necessarily appropriate.
I appreciate that. I would say we are peers, and I don't want to cut you off. I want to hear what you have to say, but also iron sharpens iron, and you have given me a lot that I don't have. And I have a lot of books in my house right now, like Oren Claff's, Sell Anything or
yeah.
That book is fantastic.
He is awesome.
What's the name of that book? It's right on my desk. I have it. I've read it. And
Pitch Anything.
That's what it is. But that changed my whole mindset around power dynamics. It flipped me upside down, because there's so many times in sales, and we're kind of going off on a tangent, but it's
okay.
Get whoever's listening, get that book. I don't care what you're doing. If you're not in sales, everyone is selling something. Yeah. And the whole concept and structure around power dynamics, I realized I was just getting eaten alive in those situations, because you're there with a goal, and you want to be sensitive to the person you're selling to. But it's like, you don't have to be the pushover in the sales meeting. You have to take control. And he just reframes that whole kind of dynamic that really was a kind of very revelatory for me, even at this late stage, later, wherever I'm at in my career, not mid-stage career, you know what I'm saying? So tell me your mindset, your winning mindset strategy. I had to go off on a tangent because too good.
February 16th, 2016, I had a friend of mine who'd been trying, Tyler Smith. I'll name him on the podcast. He's great. Tyler Smith's one of my longest time buddies in sales. And he'd been trying to, we traded books that have each been very successful for the other through the time. But he was adamant about, you got to read this book, you got to read this book. For like 3 years, he's pushing me to read this book. And I'm at one point, I'm like, I will never read that book if it, just despite him, right? Right. But he comes up with this plan to take me to the golf tournament because he knows I love golf, to get me drinking so that he can steal my keys, so he can steal the radio, so he can get me to listen to 20 minutes of Orrin Clapp. And I'm so glad he did. February 16th, Sunday night, in the dark on Highway 1 in my old Benz, Tyler takes the keys and puts on Orrin Clapp, the first 20 minutes of Pitch Anything by Orrin Clapp. And it changed my entire life, every relationship in my life. My relationship with my banker, to the relationship with the valet at the restaurant, to my wife, to my kids, to business partners, to raising money. Every single relationship in my life, good or bad, came as a tuning fork result of that. And so I would say that let me go through a quick list of books that I've read that have changed, that have really, really made magnificent improvements in my life. Number one is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
Great book. I have it. Yep.
And I didn't even, I took that. I took each of the 50 chapters and the little one sentence trigger, and I put them on a 3x5 card, stuck it in my shirt pocket for a year, and didn't take it out of my shirt pocket for a year so I could get through those. That book laid the foundation for me for being able to deal with emotional pressure and stress and dealing with other people and recognizing that they deal with all the same types of stresses. How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success Through Selling by Frank Betcher, who happened to be Dale Carnegie's best friend. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Getting Things Done by David Allen. I did a podcast, episode 14, on the David Allen podcast with Mike Williams. That massive transformation in workflow management and project management skills. Orrin Clapp's Pitch Anything, partnered with the Never Split the Difference book by Chris Voss, in The Power of Negotiating as If Your Life Depends on It. Chris Voss was the FBI hostage negotiating lead out of New York City for 20 years. And those two together, transformative relationship with dealing with people. There's lots of others, and you guys can certainly feel free to contact me on LinkedIn or email or Instagram.
Why don't you share how people can find you? I know we're kind of winding it down here, and I have one more question, but you have a podcast. I want to give you time to talk about it. So go ahead. Just tell people how they can find Jeff Heilman.
Okay. So I'm on LinkedIn. I'm the only Jeff Heilman that has worked for Oracle on LinkedIn, and you'll see a picture of my mug up there. I work for IBM, Intel, Oracle, Cisco, and co-founded Tagile. So you can look for me there. And you can find me on Instagram at Jeff Heilman, spelled out. On Twitter, I'm at JC Heilman. I've got a podcast called Jeff Heilman Project, and I've got a YouTube channel for that. You can also click through it I have it as a tile on LinkedIn as well. So the Jeff Heilman Project, we're going to be cutting episode 30 next week with you as our guest, actually. Excited about that, Mr. Bell.
I am pumped.
And we do that one with the Mrs. Jessica Heilman, my wife,
that's great.
Host on that and producer of the show. And my son Andrew actually does all the editing and the daily shorts on all our social media platforms. But to get to philosophy, here's the one-liner that I think that I could handle. My philosophy on people is, I'm a people person. I love people. I'm obsessed with serving and adding value to people. And my secret is, I love people, and I try not to keep it a secret, right? So that's as far as how I get along with people. I have a lot of energy for sure, but I just really like people. People are fascinating to me. I am sincerely interested in your life, in your relationships, and your ability to manage your family, and your ability, Matt, to grow your business, and Sam, with Sam and Katie and their life and his career in sales and figuring things out. I want people to win. I want people to feel the force of will, of love, of our Heavenly Father through whatever deliverable I can offer. From a philosophy of success, I would say is if you don't quit, you'll make it. And if you evaluate your philosophy about how you look at things, you won't quit. So if you don't quit, you'll make it. And to keep from quitting, examine your ways, examine how you do things, and get better at how you do things. And eventually you'll do things in a way where you remove the mistakes. Bill Belichick says it this way: do your job. And what he means by that is, if you do your job, you will get better at avoiding mistakes. And there's a parallel, there's a curve that I can even send you if you want to post it in the notes. There's a curve that shows that Bill Belichick wins 80% of his games literally because he doubled down on a quarterback that didn't fumble the ball or throw interceptions, and he paid a Sultan's ransom for place kickers so that he made the maximum number of field goals from any distance. And he never missed an extra point, if at all possible. And those two tiny little things are actually what he attributes his 80% win rate and those six Super Bowls that he won with Tom Brady. So it's wow. Less about I got to go out and do a land grab, or I got to hit a 400-yard drive off the tee, and more about, no, you just need to hit it down the middle, keep it in the fairway, keep it on the green, and don't three putt. And if you just do that, you'll shoot scratch golf. So hopefully that's helpful for people in business as well.
Yeah, I think so. You know what? That's a good punctuation mark to end on. Super valuable. I appreciate you joining. I learn a lot from you, and you've been a great friend and mentor. And even when I was down, you were there, one of the first people I called, and appreciate you always speaking into my life. And thanks for coming. This has been fun.
You're the best, Matt. Thanks. And we'll face offline, bro. This is a great format. And there's men out there that all a winner needs to do is know that it can be done. And there's men out there that are just looking for winners to say, yeah, you can do it. And here's how you do it. And they don't ever need to see anything again. It's more good because I saw that somebody got over the fence.
Yeah. Amen, brother. All right. Well, I will see you Tuesday, brother. Thanks for joining.
Thanks. See you Tuesday. Talk soon.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Man Fulfilled. I hope it encourages and strengthens you in your pursuit of finding purpose, health, and success. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Man Fulfilled, and you can follow me at Matthew Bell Official. And be sure to go to manfulfilled.com to join our newsletter and stay up to date on resources, events, and much more. We'll be right back.